This episode of The Gendernaut is sponsored by Casper, who makes state-of-the-art mattresses at affordable prices.
We're having a more public conversation about the complexity of Black identity, right? That, like, Black men aren't all one thing, right? Black women are all one thing. The trans community isn't all sort of one. So a Black man can be sensitive and caring and strong and vulnerable, right? All of those things in one. And you actually can see representations of that as opposed to before.
That's DeRay McKesson of Black Lives Matter, and this is The Gendernaut, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. I'm Nastran Tavakolifar, or simply Naz, and we're trying to figure out gender roles for the modern era. So let's jump in. On this episode, we talk to DeRay about masculinity, race, sexuality, and activism.
I think about being a Black man, I'm reminded of the resolve, the strength, like the vulnerability, the fortitude, and the push to create.
And we do a quick dive into the news of the week. Also, we just recorded with Mark Manson, the fantastic author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F. You'll hear him on a future episode of this podcast where we discuss if there's a crisis in masculinity. We wanted to share a bit of that with you now. Mark told us about a men's group that changed his life.
So the group was organized under the pretense of like professional advancement and like dating life advancement. Like it was very much designed as like, we're going to fix your problem, whatever it is, because that's like, men are comfortable talking that way. People showed up and they're like, you know, hey, I've got this business and we're running into a lot of problems. And, you know, I'm looking for other smart, accomplished men who can like help me out or support me, give me advice or whatever. And then, yeah, by the third meeting, they're like, I'm so lonely.
Our episode with Mark Manson will be out soon. So on to this week's episode, which is coming up after this note from our sponsor, Casper, who make finely engineered mattresses at affordable prices. From getting your beauty sleep to waking up on the wrong side of bed, you know the importance of a good night's sleep. I am very well aware of this myself. Most of the pointless arguments I get into, or days where I just feel grouchy about the state of the world, are largely down to a bad night's sleep. So, to be a generally more pleasant, productive, and fulfilled person, head over to Casper.com and purchase one of their state-of-the-art yet affordable mattresses. Casper sell their products directly to customers, cutting out middlemen and therefore slashing prices. You can get £55 off a mattress purchase by using the promo code NOT at the checkout. That's K-N-O-T. Terms and conditions do apply. Shipping and returns are free within the UK. Casper also let you try the mattresses out. You can have a 100-night free trial, test it out, and see how you find it. And if you're not happy, you can get your money back. So head over to Casper.com, C-A-S-P-E-R.com. And that promo code for you again is K-N-O-T. That's K for King, N for November, O for Orange, and T for Tango. Okay, back to the Gendernaut. This week's guest is DeRay McKesson. He's an activist, he's involved in Black Lives Matter, and he also hosts the fantastic podcast Pod Save the People, out on Crooked Media. They're the people who put out Pod Save America and some other super cool shows all about the state of the world today. We caught up with DeRay on a recent trip of his to London. Now, we were keen to talk to him for a few reasons. Being an activist is all about trying to change the world, be that the big structures of society or people's thoughts and opinions and how they interact on a daily basis. DeRay's been super active both on the ground and online, where he has a huge Twitter following. Also, he's worked in the school system. He's taught in schools in New York, as well as working with schools in Baltimore and Minneapolis. So DeRay's been busy empowering and helping young people in a manner of ways, and he knows a lot about what's impacting people, both online and in the physical world, and how things are changing. Now, the Gendernaut is all about figuring out the new masculinity and femininity. So we wanted to know how DeRay's work as an activist and also how his race and sexuality have impacted his own conception of masculinity. Before we hear from DeRay, I want to share a passage with you. It's from an interview with him in Interview magazine in April 2016, and it was done by Jack Dorsey of Twitter. Just as some background, DeRay was raised in Baltimore by his father, who was a recovering addict. I think this passage gives a really powerful insight into him and his vision. DeRay said, quote, Because my father raised us and he was going through the process of recovery, so much of my childhood was seeing adults put their lives back together and seeing people become whole again. And that process has been really powerful in terms of shaping the way I think about the world now as an adult. Because I know that we are not our worst mistakes. We are more than our pain. End quote. Here's DeRay.
I wanted to know a little bit about your own journey and whether activism has affected what it means to be a man for you.
Yeah, I think that one of the most beautiful things about the early days of protests is that it was so inclusive. Like, the police were so wild that I think that the identity issues that normally were things that held people back, like homophobia, sexism in some ways, patriarchy in some ways, were just mitigated just because we were forced to work together in such close quarters. So I remember one day in October of 2014 where there was a protester who yelled like faggot at one of the police officers, and another protester, mind you, was like wild outside, and another protester was like, that really offended me. He was like, you know, I'm sorry. And that small exchange is something that like normally doesn't happen. So when I think about how much it's changed in 3 years is that we're having public conversation about identity in ways that we've never had before. I always think about protests as this idea of telling the truth in public. I don't know how the movement space would be if we had not had those conversations and continue to have them. I'm mindful though that the conversations like aren't enough, right? That like talking about the world doesn't just magically change the world, that it requires like real work at the system and structure level. But it has been really heartening. I think that I would have never thought in those earliest days of protests that one of the byproducts of us all being out in the street together would be this really thoughtful ability to talk about identity better.
Mm-hmm. And as a gay black man, what are the sorts of conversations happening that wouldn't have happened 3 or 4 years ago?
Like the trans community? We're talking mm-hmm. about trans as an identity in a way that we just like 3 years ago I didn't hear. We just didn't have the language to talk about it in public. We didn't talk about women and the role of women leadership in this way before. Not in public, you know, obviously in academic communities and activist circles, like there'd always been this progressive language around identity. And it's sad that we even have to call identity work progressive. Like this, we had just been able to recognize people. But the public conversation has shifted now, and that's really powerful.
And how does that affect young black men that you work with? Especially because I'm sure there's a lot of sort of teenagers and people in their early 20s who really look up to you and your work. Are you hearing conversations from them or questions from them that are different from sort of when you were their age?
I think that young people just don't know what it was like, you know, 15 years ago, right? I think about going to high school, and in high school it wasn't a place where like you could be whoever you were and you could dress, like that just wasn't what it was like. And now, so I see kids now and they get to show up in like the fullness of who they are, and it's just different, you know? So I think that they benefit from it in ways that they don't know, and that's completely fine. I also think that there's space now for people to push, and there wasn't before. So there are people who are probably still transphobic and certainly still homophobic and still patriarchal. But we think about those conversations on Twitter and in Facebook, or like in just in places, like in schools, that there's language for this stuff now that is accessible, not just in academic circles, that I think is probably like the biggest byproduct. So we can talk about masculinity so fragile, which was like a hashtag, or we can talk about representations of men in the media or in sports or on TV in ways that we just like weren't having open conversations about before.
Do you think that it's allowed for a different type of black masculinity to sort of emerge? And not that it necessarily didn't exist, but to sort of be more out in the open?
Yeah, I think that we're having more public conversation about the complexity of black identity, right? That like black men aren't all one thing, right? Black women are all one thing. The trans community isn't all sort of one. So a black man can be sensitive and caring and strong and vulnerable, right? All of those things in one. And you actually can see representations of that, as opposed to before, the only public conversation we're having about black men was like thugs and dangerous and people who are criminals, right? Like, and this idea that, you know, people who have committed crime are also fathers and brothers, and, you know, like just the moving away from the flattening of identity is, I think, what has happened over the past 3 years.
So I was reading about your own upbringing. So you were raised by a father who was a recovering addict. What about when you were sort of in those kind of early teen years? What was it like sort of trying to come together with your sort of black identity, even though you know you had very different role models who, you know, were caring and vulnerable and sort of growing on a day-to-day basis. I'm just wondering how you try to reconcile what you were seeing as the public conversation with what was actually happening in your own life.
Yeah, I don't think there was much of a progressive public conversation back then when I was growing up. You know, I was mindful of the images of black people, right? It was like comedians, athletes, or like if you were lucky, there were lawyers, right? Like it was a pretty flat sort of landscape of what black leadership or role models look like. And I went to a middle and high school that was majority white. So, you know, I grew up like many people having to be like the black person who was sort of interpreting an experience for people, even if I didn't want to be that person. I was a youth organizer as a young person. So though I went to schools that were majority white, like the work that I did and community that was the community that I was around the most was people of color. So I was always mindful of like what systemic trauma looked like, even if I didn't have the language to name it. I think that being an adult gave me the language to name it and to think about solutions in a much more root cause way.
What you were just describing, did that, in terms of where you were being educated and then working in black communities, did that make it hard for people to relate to you in the communities? Like, were you seen as a bit of an other?
No, I grew up in the city I went to elementary school in the city. My father, who, as you said, was a recovering addict and has been clean for probably 30 years now, he didn't go to college. He graduated from high school, and he didn't know he didn't know how to make an impact with us educationally besides moving so we could go to different schools, right? That was his solution.
Which is a smart solution as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so we went to different schools, so that meant that we were no longer living in the city. So we split time between, like, the house we sort of lived in, which was like our street address, and then my grandmother's house, which was still in the city. So no, it wasn't hard for people to relate. I think that I just lived in a dual world because I went to this school that did not look like the communities I grew up in, for sure, and definitely didn't look like the communities the work that I worked on was in. But even in the county, there were pockets of black people, right, who lived in a poverty that looked very different than the white parts of the county. So I was mindful of those things, and we were all mindful of those things.
Mm-hmm. Duray, a moment ago you were talking about leadership. Now, what's really interesting is when you look at Black Lives Matter, it's kind of very decentralized, and it's not like, you know, more traditional forms of leadership where there's like a leader or like a core kind of leadership group. And I think when we're talking about like leadership and stuff, we often see this as a slightly more feminine approach. So it's all like open source and inclusive and stuff. I'm wondering how you reconcile that with being a male activist. Like, are there still pressures for you to behave a certain way as a man who's an activist that might not jive with Black Lives Matter or like your mode of activism?
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who definitely who think I'm like, I can't actually be whatever their definition of radical is because I'm gay, right? Or they're used to sort of a, quote, man showing up in a traditionally aggressive way, both in affect and ideas.
So they expect you to behave that way when you show up?
Yeah, so people just, or there's no way that I can behave that'll actually meet their expectation, right? That it's impossible for me to actually fight on their behalf because I'm gay. So I think that is probably like the most prevalent thing that I've experienced. In terms of sort of leadership, it is really important in this moment that we are creating space for people to lead in ways that highlight their unique gifts and abilities, as opposed to us saying like, here's a role for you and getting people to fit that role. And I think about myself as somebody who in the early days of protests, you know, I was one of the tweeters. There were people who were live streamers. There were people who were like leading the chants. There were people who were in the back room thinking about strategy. And everybody was important. Like, none of us could have worked without the other being very good at what they did. And it was powerful to see the space just open up so people could like find their role, as opposed to like a central team sort of identifying people and saying that this is the role that they needed to play.
Just a moment ago though, when you were saying that people sometimes expect you to be a certain type of radical, like, are there examples of what people would say or expect from you at like a meeting or a protest or something?
You know, it's interesting because the rhetoric is that people like don't like charismatic leadership or don't want that. You know, people are used to the black man who's really upset, you know, like yelling or like, you know, there's a style of leadership that people are used to for whatever reason. Or there's just a way that people think about, like, the way you should critique. So if I am sort of pretty chill being like, you know, people are racist and they shouldn't be racist, for some people that isn't as aggressive as they would like, or for other people, there's actually nothing I can do to meet the bar. So there's no type of speech, there's no type of platform, there's no, like, I actually can't do anything because me being gay precludes me ever meeting the bar of what it means to be a man to them.
So it's your sexuality more than anything else that...
In the activist community, yeah.
Oh, okay, I see. But these people, are they sort of a certain... I'm wondering, are they of a certain generation or background? Like, can you tell?
No, I think it's, like, pretty...
Across the board?
Across the board, yeah. For some people. And I think that in that space we've grown, right? I think that, like, homophobia, people have worked through their own issues over the past 3 years. But I think it is definitely still present.
And when you talk about the space, are you talking about within the Black community or activism, like grassroots activism in general?
Activism in general. That mm-hmm. like, yeah, I think the activism in general. And, you know, the internet has allowed people, the gift and the curse of it is access, right? So there's some people who, you know, I think about, I'm in proximity to ideas every day that I never would have been exposed to, and that is amazing, and I'm pushed every day. There are also people who feel more empowered to be sort of hateful or sort of wild in a way that they would never otherwise be, but because the internet allows like a form of distance and anonymity. So I don't think that we've leveled out like what it means to actually disagree or be in conflict yet on the internet in ways that are actually productive.
Just on the point of the internet, I was interested to ask you about social media because you're so active on social media. We hear a lot about how it affects younger people, especially teenage girls, in quite a negative way. I'm wondering how it affects young Black men. Again, in some ways you talked about there's access to information, but then it can also be like quite a hostile place. Just wondering like your experiences and with sort of young Black men as well, whether the internet has helped them forge their identities or if it's like sort of a bit more nuanced.
Yeah, I think that with all marginalized people, the internet, certainly social media, has allowed people to communicate in ways that didn't exist before, has accelerated the pace of those communications, has given voice and access to ideas that like you just didn't, that were much harder to come by. I think that the downside is that I'm not convinced that we were designed to take this much feedback so often. So I think that that does something to you. So what we hear about young girls, right, is like the addiction to likes and sort of the trauma with self-image that comes into that. I think that there's some cities in America for sure where some of the community violence that manifests is actually because of social media. It's because you tweeted that thing about me or made that Facebook post about her or him. And then we see that leading to offline violence. And like that is sort of an interesting and different phenomenon because the distance allows for a different type of anonymity than existed before. So it makes it easier to harm people because, like, you only know them on Facebook and you never knew them in real life anyway. So I worry about those things. I think that we'll probably see in the coming years, like, a leveling, like, more of a decorum about how to disagree online and what that actually looks like in a way that we just don't know.
Well, the online space is interesting because there's all this talk about sort of white supremacy and white racism going on online. I'm wondering how that has affected your work over the past 2 or 3 years. Where there's been this sort of mushrooming of these ideas. But again, like you say, you would probably not hear face to face, but you know, yeah, you've got that space.
For sure, and I think that I think that people are talking about that. I think that people aren't actually talking about how the internet is helping to quietly radicalize people. So you think about the white supremacist accounts on Instagram that have 200,000 followers, right? They're not all trolls. Like those are actually regular people who are ingesting these memes and choosing to ingest them every day, and they're a part of a subset of a community. And I worry about that more than I worry about the overt stuff too. But I think that the quiet organizing that's happening, that is radicalizing people and reinforcing these really negative ideas, is actually potentially the most damaging.
So you mean sort of radicalizing in sort of people who aren't at the extremes, kind of more, I don't want to say normal people, but people who are more regular in their viewpoints.
Yeah, people who aren't gonna carry tiki torches, but still support all of those ideas, right? Where are young people, you know, because you're not born racist, so like where are you actually ingesting this language? And for some people, it is at home, and for some people, it is actually the internet. And that the internet, again, this is like the beauty and the curse, is that it allows you not to feel alone. So there's some people who probably should feel pretty ostracized by their ideas, but the internet has created this space where, like, we can all just share these racist memes back and forth, and our accounts are locked, so nobody sees it, or we only see it. And I think that that actually has a huge impact that, like, is not gone studied and explored enough.
I feel like in the culture, we often hear about the negative experiences of Black people and Black men. What are the sort of most positive parts of being a Black man that you think should be celebrated and that could be inspiring to everyone in society?
Yeah, I think that Blackness, you know, we are not only our pain, right? That, like, there's so much joy in Blackness, which is so beautiful. A people that have overcome so much and have figured out how to, like, still be culture leaders and culture creators in the midst of all of that. So when I think about being a Black man, I'm reminded of the resolve, the strength, like the vulnerability, the fortitude, and the push to create. So you think about hip hop, you think about rap, you think about all these things, you think of rock and roll that were created by Black people that, like, led to cultural revolutions and, like, so many ideas. So I'm mindful of those things.
Who would you say is the Black man that you find most inspiring?
Oh, I think that, you know, I think that James Baldwin wrote in a lyrical way that still influences so many people. I think about Jay-Z as, like, an interesting sort of person who's alive today, like, just the vision for what he wants his life to be. You know, I think there are parts of Obama's sort of path to power that are like interesting models, whether you agree with him as a policymaker or not. So I'm fascinated by that. Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to ask, I should have asked earlier, but when we were talking about leadership, so some of the most prominent people in Black Lives Matter are women, including some of the people who founded it. Do they have expectations on you to behave a certain way as a Black man, positive or negative?
Yeah, so remember that nobody founded a movement, right? That there are people who, like, helped create a hashtag, but the people are people who came outside and, like, made a movement move. One of the most beautiful things about the movement is precisely that, like, no one, two, or three people sat down in a room and were like, we're going to do this, right? It was like everybody came outside and stayed. So this language of founding is always really interesting to those of us who were there.
But so my question itself is, I meant more sort of the women who are very prominent at the start.
So there are people who help make the hashtag, and yeah, that is important work. Mm. Different from starting an entire movement. People think about this founding as if they're like people sat in a room and were like, we're all going to get together. And, like, that isn't what happened. Yeah. And that language actually erases all the people who actually did put their bodies on the line, right, to protest and do that work. But what is true is that there are women who are doing incredible things in the movement and are rightly visible, right? Like, that we're recognizing that labor and that we're recognizing the input and the gifts and the thoughts. The trans community, same thing. The incredible trans leaders in the country, the incredible gay Black men who were essentially moved out of the movement, the civil rights movement, who, like, now have space. So all of those things are important. I don't think that there's any expectation on me necessarily. I think that we all are, even when we disagree, we're trying to make sure that everybody's, like, pushing concrete work and that, like, there's actually, like, a plan for people to go to. That's important.
That was DeRay McKesson. Now we're going to have a quick chat about the news of the past week. Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood film producer who's been accused by many women of multiple sexual assaults. There have been rumors for years about his conduct, and the fact that he was one of the most powerful men in Hollywood meant that a lot of women were forced into staying silent, and some were even paid to stay silent, or they were silenced if they did speak up, as people's entire careers could be on the line. Now, we don't want to get into the details too much, as you can read all about these online, and this story is moving fast. Now, Katie Vogue, the co-producer of this podcast, and I got together to talk about the Weinstein revelations and some of the important issues they highlight. Also, the past few episodes of The Gender Knot have been all about women speaking up, women calling people out, and about whether they can do that and how it goes down when they do. So the news about Weinstein brings a lot of those conversations to the fore. We'll leave you with our efforts to untangle it all.
What is interesting is that a lot of these accusations are from, like, 20 years ago,
yeah,
or decades ago and stuff. Now they're being brought to light. On one hand, it's the change in the culture, right? Because we've had other well-known men who are very loved. I don't know, Bill Cosby and others. Right.
I don't know, it's been an interesting week because there's also been a lot of criticism about why didn't these women speak up earlier.
One of the pieces I read, it was there was a quote from Rose McGowan, who, you know, is one of the most prominent and outspoken women who's accused Weinstein of rape, talked about how she was in touch with a New York Times journalist for 15 years or something and kept saying, no, wait, the culture's not ready, and saw the recent culture shift with Cosby, like you mentioned, as an opportunity finally.
But she was still silenced by Twitter this week, which is so interesting, when she called out Ben Affleck and she was banned for like 12 hours or something. And what was really impressive was all these people coming to her defense online. But then the other big discussion I've been seeing a lot is kind of like, why didn't these women come out earlier? Which is kind of one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't.
It was so just quite well known within these circles. Not just, oh, they didn't report it, but just so many people knew. And they were talking amongst each other. I think Ashley Judd was talking about that. Oh, yeah, you know, we've amongst each other, we women have been discussing this forever.
Well, that's where it's interesting, because the women discuss it amongst themselves because they need to protect themselves.
Themselves and each other. And if,
but then I'm thinking,
if
why
it's an effort to protect themselves and others, they, to call it out publicly is obviously the it would go farther in terms of protecting people in the future.
Well, then my question is, why didn't the men step in? Because loads of men knew. And that's my question, because you can see why the women wouldn't step in, because even if they're talking amongst themselves, they're still sort of potential targets for this guy, you know? Right. So there's a reason why they might have to keep it under the radar, just out of their own safety. But that just really does make me wonder about the men who didn't speak up. And so with Rose McGowan being banned from Twitter is because she called out Ben Affleck, where she's like, you knew and you didn't do anything. That's the bit I find really interesting, the amount of guys who are coming out and suddenly, you know, speaking up against him. And it's like, you didn't do this back then. Or it's people like Seth MacFarlane, who he made this joke where he announced the nominees for one of the Academy Awards. And then he said something like, these women no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
And I get that, like, humor is an important way of raising issues, but like, you know, is that it? I remember watching that clip, and then he gave this commentary about, like, yeah, he had, you know, tried something with my friend, and I was really angry about it. And watching that clip, he didn't seem that angry. It seemed like, you know, a funny little joke he dropped in, which really made me angry watching that. They're like, oh, he thinks he's done his bit by, you know, dropping in an indirect quote.
Yeah, but indirect I don't know, joke. But it's, I mean, this may sound pessimistic, but at the end of the day, this whole thing is about power. So many of the quotes from people coming forward have been, he was this huge, huge, larger-than-life figure, had so much power in Hollywood. And speaking to what you just said, your question, again, this is going to sound pessimistic, but women had something to gain, actually, protecting themselves and others, and sounds bad, but men maybe didn't, except for, you know, protecting their loved ones and women that they cared about. But in terms of putting their own career on the lines, they weren't potential victims, like you said.
When we spoke to Mark Manson, and we put this term about the silence around him, well, he had something interesting to say, because it's obvious that a lot of women would know because they're talking amongst themselves, or right, they've been targeted. But the question being about, like, did enough men even know about
this? Did
they
even know, yeah.
It's hard to get into it too much because, I mean, I just don't think enough details are known. I'm sure there were other men around him. Like, look, like, if you've got a scumbag like Harvey, guys like that tend to hang out with other guys like that. And so my guess is a lot of the men who were aware of what was going on didn't necessarily see a whole lot wrong with it, or they were kind of the same way. Generally, it's like, if you're a guy who's disgusted by a man like that, you're not going to end up hanging out with him much anyway, or your relationship with him is going to be strictly professional. And so you're not going to be aware of a lot of this stuff. So, you know, in the news right now, you're seeing a lot of like fingers being pointed and like, oh, this guy knew or that person knew. And that may be true, but it may not be. I think it's hard to say. I think the overall point that's important is that obviously there were people close to him that were aware of what was going on. But I don't know how much of the silence about it was necessarily like a masculinity thing, like a bro thing. Mm-hmm. And how much of it was just like, these are people's careers. Like, you know, if you're a man who's working at his company and you see this going on, you know, on the one hand, if you say something, like, your career is going to be destroyed, and, you know, you probably have a family and a mortgage and all this stuff. So like the people around him, both male and female, were like put in really, really horribly difficult positions.
yeah, maybe enough men who would have been the type to speak up didn't know enough. I don't know.
We don't know if there were guys that did, men that did speak up, and they also got a payout, or were intimidated to then just step down, or... I sort of feel bad about saying this thing about, you know, men didn't have anything to win. That sounds, or to gain out of speaking up, that sounds awful. But I think the point I'm just trying to make is that everyone, so many people in the industry are and have been so intimidated by him, that that was his power and that was his presence.
Man or woman.
Yeah.
You heard from DeRay McKesson of Black Lives Matter and Pod Save the People on this episode of The Gender Knot, where we explored masculinity, race, sexuality, and activism. You also briefly heard from Mark Manson, and this episode was hosted by me. I'm Naz, or Nastran Tavakoli Farr in full, and it was co-produced by the fantastic Katie Vogue, who you heard from at the end as well. Next week, we're asking, why don't men talk? We're delving into this with the MC and poet Disraeli, who's on a mission to get men to open up after he did just that, and it transformed his life. As always, you can find out more at thegenderknot.com and get in touch via thegenderknot@gmail.com. We really appreciate all your thoughts and comments. Please take a moment to leave us a review on iTunes, and we'll speak to you next week. Bye for now.